I've seen that movie.
Jealous and crazy about it.
Oh, what
is wrong with you?
I don't want any insults, all right?
I've got the insults.
No, well, not in the t-shirt business.
Welcome to the second podcast from Turner and Looch. This is Cass and Looch speaking.
I am Matthew Turner.
Rosy cheeks, Matthew Turner there.
Rosy cheeks, how dare you?
Anyway, on this week's show, we're going to be talking about this week's releases.
We're going to be talking about some film news.
Some breaking film news.
The US box office top five and the 10th place on the top five, if you see what I mean. We're going to talk a little bit about Fright Fest, which is happening this weekend. Although by the time you listen to this, it probably would have already happened.
Hey, see, you're insulting my editing.
No, not at all. I'm just realistically speaking, we probably won't get it up till Sunday. People probably won't listen to it till Monday.
I can get this if you stop fucking about. I'll get it in a can.
All right, fine.
And live by Friday.
We're going to talk about the DVD of the week very briefly, and that's all we've got.
I think that's more than enough. We had less than that last weekend. We went for an hour 45.
That's true.
So
yeah.
Right. Get on with it then, Matthew. What's first up?
It's you first, film news.
Can we change the order, please? Because I've fired up my film news here. No, that's not true. Here's the film news right here. And we're going to start off with something that we're going to lead on to later on as well, Fright Fest. We're right in the midst of it here, and we're still trying to gather all the information. But the big film from Fright Fest has been pulled.
Yeah, Serbian film. Rumours suggest it's because there's a bit where we're chucks a can in the bin.
Matthew's lost it. Apparently, I earlier made a joke on Twitter about...
I made a joke!
I don't know what you're talking about. I made a joke...
Fuck you! You're not stealing my jokes! Okay. I made a joke on Twitter earlier saying I hadn't read it. Well, actually, it's half true. I haven't read any of the details for a Serbian film.
You don't know what? Hang on. You don't know what it's about?
I do know what it's about, right. And I know about the animatronic baby. I don't know anything else. I don't know any of the other stuff people are supposedly horrified by. Anyway, I said I haven't really read up on the details of a Serbian film. Is there a bit where a woman chucks a cat in a bin? And somebody took that and turned it and put it on the Wikipedia page. So the Wikipedia page now has a plot summary and then says at the end, and there's a bit where he showed a video of a woman chucking a cat in a bin. It's not really as funny when you say it.
No, it's not.
I think that's my first, but I think that is the first time I've ever kind of gone viral with something in that sense, if it counts as going viral.
I don't find anything funny about putting a cat in a bin.
There isn't anything funny about putting a cat in a bin. Don't put cats in bins, kids.
Why are you mocking it? Why are you making light of it? It's serious.
I'm not mocking it.
That's why it's been pulled, because there's the scene of a cat in a bin.
Speaking of which, if you are particularly upset by scenes involving cats, whatever you do, well, put it this way. When you see a cat in The Last Exorcism, hide your eyes for a good kind of couple of minutes because there is a cat scene in there that really has to be seen to be believed. Bad things happen to that cat, yeah.
Yeah. The BBFC...
No, we won't give it away.
Well, maybe when we talk about it next week. The BBFC are apparently the ones behind the film being pulled. They demanded 4 minutes or so of cuts to a Serbian film, which the Fright Fest directors quite understandably said no. And so we don't get a Serbian film.
I think there's more to the story than that from what I've heard. Westminster Council are involved somehow. Whether they said they wouldn't give a decision on banning it or not banning it until the BBFC had given it a certificate, knowing that the BBC would probably require cuts, I suspect that's what's happened. Because normally festivals, and certainly Fright Fest in the past, has shown things that the BBC haven't had certificates for.
The BBFC. So I'll catch you out like last time.
Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah. Well, they've also cut I Spit on Your Grave.
I know.
45 seconds or so from that has been cut, although that is going ahead and that will be screened.
I really want to know. I mean, obviously, no one wants to break the law or anything, but I really want to know what would happen if Fright Fest went ahead and showed best films anyway. Because I know, like the ICA recently, several years ago, the ICA had a series of banned films, which, you know, notoriously the BBFC had either been banned outright or the BBFC had refused certificates to or whatever.
Mm.
And they showed all of those, no problem at all. They could sell tickets for them and they showed them. So, and film festivals, particularly a film festival dedicated to horror movies, whose audience is primarily made up of people who like horror movies and who aren't necessarily going to be upset or offended. I mean, yes, general audience, fine. General audience, no one in the general audience is going to go and see a Serbian film, I would think. Anybody who knows what a Serbian film is about isn't going to be interested in going to see it. It's not like bloody, you know, Scott Pilgrim or anything. for a festival dedicated to horror movies and for people who love horror movies, to have to show a cut version of a film, it just seems ridiculous to me.
Well, this is where my confusion comes from, because it's been shown uncut in places like the US, where you would expect it to be cut to shreds or banned outright. And yet it's gone through festivals and been shown quite extensively. And yet
it was at Cannes. How many other festivals has it done?
What, a Serbian film? I did the, whatever the equivalent of Fright Fest is in the US. So it's been shown in the US, is the bottom line there. Mm. And if it's going to be shown there, then you'd think we'd get to see it here. And no one's expecting it to come out uncut on DVD or when the theatrical release comes around. But you'd think at a festival, like you say, dedicated to horror and the more extreme elements of cinema. It's been a while since the BBFC have got involved in this sort of capacity.
Yeah, that's the biggest surprise. I mean, that's why I think Westminster Council is involved.
So yeah, we'll be talking a little bit more about Fright Fest and some of the picks that we've outlined from there. I know you've seen a couple of the films already, so...
I've seen about four of them, yeah.
Save it. Let's talk about the next bit on the news, which is the sequel to Ghost Rider is in the works, and it's...
That's your film news.
That's my film news.
I'm really loving the fact that we've got a regular slot where you give the most rubbish film news imaginable.
It's called...
Sequel to Ghost Rider.
It's called The Spirit...
You heard it here first, everyone. Sequel to Ghost Rider.
Not first. It's called The Spirit of Vengeance. It's shooting in 3D, and it kicks off production towards the end of the year in Romania. It's the writing and directing team behind the Crank films, and Nicolas Cage is back.
Really?
That's all I know
the
so
Crank
far.
Guys are doing Ghost Rider. Oh my
Indeed,
god.
Indeed.
Totally
yes.
Mental.
Okay,
I can see
Crank 2 was awful.
Crank 2 was awful. Shite. Yeah, I agree.
And aren't the guys who did that also the guys behind Gamer as well?
Yeah, which is also not very good.
Exactly. So I think their hype has kind of proceeded and...
I've got a slight confession to make. I quite like Ghost Rider.
I don't think it was the worst comic book film either. I think, some bits worked, some bits didn't work.
Better than Daredevil?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Better than Elektra?
Yep.
Better than several other comic book movies. But also, just quite good fun. Like, sort of cheesy, quite good fun comic book movie, basically.
I think Nicolas Cage gets it. I think that's the thing with that.
He's a big fan.
He's a massive fan of it. Yeah, it's sort of his dream role. So, and he, like I said, he's the only one confirmed.
That's what's to play a character called Johnny Blaze.
I thought he might have got it out of his system after Kick-Ass, where he kind of played the antithesis to all this sort of the classical comic book characters. But no, he's back in for another hit. 3D as well, which I think is going to be... Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've been impressed.
Are they shooting it in 3D?
Yeah, okay.
That's
I've been impressed by the last couple of 3D films I've seen, which were the Avatar remake and Piranha, but I suspect you won't get that sort of element from Ghost Rider.
Yeah, but you go one more back and you've got The Last Airbender.
True that. Mm. True that. Okay.
Next bit of film news, please, Mr. Leach.
Next bit of film news, yeah, hot off the presses. Well, it's not that hot anyway. Dustin Hoffman is back in the Focus franchise.
After the one that's about to come out.
Yeah, well, they finished making that one.
Yeah.
And he wasn't in it, but now they're reshooting scenes with him in it because he's agreed to be in it.
Oh,
yeah.
That's weird.
The trailer is out now if you have a look at it.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it's called, actually.
Meet the Little Focus?
Little Focus is right, yeah. And he's not in the trailer, obviously, because he didn't film any scenes for it.
That's weird.
They've come to an agreement. He's back in it, and they're going to reshoot scenes with him in it. So, yeah.
But Dustin Hoffman, obviously desperate to be in Little Fockers. How dare you make Little Fockers without me? I can't do a good Dustin Hoffman impression, sadly. But anyway.
Do you do any decent impressions?
Yeah, given some preparation time, yeah.
No, given... No,
off the top of my head, no.
So, no impressions.
No, I can do some.
Who can you do? You don't need to do them.
I'll bust them out while we're mid-podcast. Today.
There you go.
But in future podcasts, perhaps.
I can do some awesome ones.
Go on.
A mouse went for a walk in a deep, dark wood. Hoo-ha! A fox saw the mouse, and a mouse looked good. Where are you going, little mouse?
Next bit of news is Piranha 3D has already got sequels lined up for it, given its... Well, it did all right. It didn't do tremendous business, but given that it only cost $24
million... Opened at number 6, made $10.35 million its opening weekend.
Only cost $24 million to make...
And Scott Pilgrim.
Well, it made more
in its opening weekend than Scott Pilgrim did.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
I think so, yeah.
We'll check back to last week's show when you actually gave the numbers out, and I think you'll find you're mistaken there.
I might be mistaken. I've got the numbers here, actually. The numbers are... Oh, 10.52. It made the same.
Yeah.
Basically, 10 million. Just slightly less, actually. Just slightly less.
So I was right, yes. Scott Pilgrim made more opening weekend than Piranha 3D. But Piranha 3D cost a lot less to make, and therefore has got sequels green-litten, or green-lighted.
Green-lighted.
Green light has been given. Green lit doesn't sound right.
Green lit, I think it's
right. Yeah, I said that, but it doesn't sound right.
Now, the question is, with the Piranha sequels, can we give away the ending?
No.
Well, sequel, that's because it's one of the best jokes in the film.
Yeah, there is a nice lead into what could be a potential sequel.
The film is left open for a sequel, yeah, but whether the sequels will actually continue where...
Well, no, well, this is the problem, because the rumour is they're going to start shooting in Thailand, and so they'd have to transfer the whole story to a different sort of location. Unless they take some of the central characters, but then again, it wouldn't really work in that sort of environment, I don't think.
The following contains a spoiler for Piranha 3D.
Yeah.
Besides, Kelly Brook's dead, might as well move on. Although
that's a spoiler, that's not going in.
Oh no, that means you can't do the bit about how to bring Kelly Brook back. Like, so have her as her own twin sister investigating her sister's death.
Nah, we won't.
Which has been covered up by the legal authorities.
We won't be using that.
Come on, that's good.
Okay. A Serbian film that is getting made is the new one from Angelina Jolie, which she is writing and directing. It's a film set in...
Write that down?
No, that was all me.
I bet you've written that down.
Look, have a look at the screen.
I bet you've written down the Serbian film that is
no,
being made. No,
that's all me.
Off the top of your head.
Fucking awesome. I'll put that properly in there. Anyway, yeah, she's apparently going to write and direct her first film.
I think I need to learn how to edit, because you've got all the power.
I know.
That's not good.
I've seen that movie.
Great. Mind you, editing also a lot of work. So.
It's time-consuming, especially when people talk. The film focuses on a Serbian man and a Bosnian woman who meet on the eve of the war and the effect the war has on their relationship. She's writing and directing it. So
she's writing and directing it, but not starring in it.
Well, I don't think she'd star in it, no, unless she casts herself as a Bosnian woman.
She does have a sort of vaguely Eastern European look.
Yeah, some sort of Slovak look. Yeah, she could do it. I think she's probably...
Well, she's weird considering there isn't that. She doesn't have that. You know, her mother's French, isn't she?
Okay.
I think. Jolie, I think.
I don't know if that's how it works.
I'm pretty sure it is.
Well, yeah, okay.
Is that all the film news?
No, there's a bit more.
Oh,
you complained, you bitched and moaned.
No. Bring on the film news.
Okay.
The film news is quite possibly my favourite bit.
Scream 4 is in production at the moment, and two cameos that have been confirmed are Kristen Bell and Anna Paquin returning. Well, not returning,
Paquin.
Making... Paquin. Paquin. Paquin.
Paquin.
Anna Paquin.
Paquin?
It's written
Anna Paquin.
Anna Paquin. Oh, no, Anna Paquin, yeah, that's how they say it.
Paquin, it sounds so wrong. Paquin. Paquin. Paquin.
The bird from True Blood is in it as well as Kristen Bell.
She's married.
Yeah, she is to...
If you saw the piano in the, believe me, if you saw the piano in the cinema,
yeah.
That shit can make you feel old.
Matthew, hate to break it to you.
Yeah, sure.
You are old, son. People returning to the franchise are Courtney Cox, Neve Campbell. I knew you said that. There you go. And David Arquette, as well as Emma Roberts and Hayden Panettiere, who have already been lined up, and Rory Culkin as well.
Panettiere?
Yeah. What did you say?
You just make it sound like three words. Panettiere.
Panettiere is how you say it.
Panettiere.
Panettiere.
Say it faster.
She's French-Canadian, isn't she?
But say it faster.
No, I'll say it.
Hayden Panettiere.
This is radio. Panettiere. It's, you know... I'm sure the female viewers, listeners to this podcast would appreciate my pronunciation rather than yours.
Mine's correct.
Who cares about accuracy when it comes to stuff like that?
I do.
I should tell you now that my voice is on the verge of giving up at any point.
Good.
So, unfortunately, it might become the Matthew Turner Show at some point. So,
oh, what a terrible,
tune out
what
at that
terrible
point.
Disaster that would be.
I'll save as much from the edit as I can.
Turner.
Oh, God, yeah. Your turn, Turner.
US box office, are we doing?
No, well...
Is there more film news? Oh, please, let there be more film news.
It's film TV news, which I think is of interest. Reported last week that Smallville is coming back.
25th of September?
Yeah, in the US it starts. Alison Mack, who wasn't scheduled to be back, has now said she will be back for at least 5 new episodes in the series. The door is also left open for Lex Luthor to return.
Oh, great.
Although, unfortunately, he has not confirmed at this point yet that he will be in it. And also Laura Vandervoort, who plays Kara.
She's heavily in Supergirl. She's heavily in the trailer. Mm. Or at least she's featured in the trailer. And that trailer I sent you said that had the producers saying they're bringing back everybody, basically. Mm. So
to the point
I'd
that
be
two
very
characters,
surprised if Lex Luthor doesn't turn up by the end of the series.
Well, two characters who are dead are apparently coming back as well. Lex Luthor's dad and Clark Kent's dad. So they'll both be back for at least two series. So all looking good on the Smallville.
I hope Chloe comes back and gets killed off.
Not a fan of the Chloe character?
I'm not a fan of Chloe, no. Well, I thought they were going to turn her into the Watchtower. I thought she was going to become like the kind of computerized voice of the Watchtower, and that would be it.
Right.
And that would be quite cool, because they were calling her Watchtower at one point.
Yeah. Right. But yeah, that is the news. There we go. That's all for the news this week. You'd get more morsels of, great stuff. Oh, fuck it. Go on. To the next bit.
Right, we're going to talk about the US box office top five again.
Correct.
I've actually written down all 10 because Piranha was in there and The Switch was in there and Inception was still in there in the bottom five, but we'll see how it goes.
Switch didn't do well, did it? Oh, well, anyway, let's get on to that.
Switch didn't do well, no. Opened at number 8. So number 1 is again The Expendables, second week. Had, interestingly, the same size drop-off of Scott Pilgrim, 52.6%, which is a massive drop-off. But still made enough to be to get the number one spot. It made 16.5 million, now has a total of 64 million. Really depressing entry in number two. Very depressing if you're kind of rooting for Scott Pilgrim to do well and other stuff. Number two, you know what it is?
No, I don't actually. I'm worried.
Vampires Suck.
Oh god.
The latest spoof movie from the date movie, epic movie, disaster movie guys. I don't know if you've ever seen one of these movies. They're absolutely.
I've seen one of them. I've seen all of them, I suspect.
You've seen all of them?
There's one decent one, superhero movie.
That's not made by the same guy.
No, that's the thing. Disaster movie is, and that's atrocious.
They're all the same.
Meet the Spartans is probably the worst, I think.
Yeah, one of them. Yeah. Date movie's pretty bad.
Date movie is bad as well.
The thing about these films is, there's no imagination there beyond referencing another film. That's all they've got. Mm-hmm. They rely on their audiences to go, oh, I've seen that movie, and that's it. Or, they chuck a piano on Britney Spears' head. They have a Britney Spears lookalike and they chuck a piano on her head and expect the audience to go, they chucked the piano on Britney Spears' head. And it's just, they're insulting.
The last ones had loads of scenes of Amy Winehouse just because she was in the news at that point. And whole jokes on Pop Idol and things like that, and not jokes. That's the point. They just get their one
references. That's all they are.
And impressions, and that's it. Not anything funny whatsoever.
They're not even impressions. They're literally just lookalikes. And they put a character based on Juno in Disaster Movie because Juno was a movie that came out the year before.
Yeah.
It's just, please don't go and see it. Tell your friends not to go and see it.
How dare you? Wait for a review before you don't go and see it.
I'm telling you right now, it's going to be terrible. I went through the.
That's a bit rich.
I flicked through the...
you're going to go and see, aren't you?
I have to.
Well, you don't have to.
You're not going to give them any money.
That week.
Not going to give them any money.
You could watch something else that week.
I was flicking through I was doing a caption competition with some friends, and I was flicking through the stills for that movie, and it's just the most depressing... Go on the IMDb and have a look at the stills, and you will not want to go and see the movie after you've done
that. It's a pastiche of the Twilight films and the vampire films and TV stuff on at the moment. But yeah, we pretty much know what we're going to get.
Pastiche of the, that's giving it too much.
Yeah.
Number three is Eat, Pray, Love, the Julia Roberts movie we talked about last week, in which Julia Roberts presumably does some eating, some praying, and some loving, although we don't know if that's actually true.
Oh, I read a little bit about it. Javier Bardem's in it as well.
Okay.
So it's quite interesting.
I couldn't tell from the picture whether it was Javier Bardem or the guy that plays...
Now you might have got me worried, because I only looked at that picture as well, and I assumed it was Javier Bardem.
I think it might be Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
Jeffrey Dean Morgan, you might be right.
Pass for Javier Bardem.
Yeah.
Squint.
Ah, we'll know by the time
it's done. It sounds like the kind of thing he'd do. And it doesn't sound like
he did that god-awful thing with Uma Thurman.
Yeah.
One of the worst ones I've ever seen. No.
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
Accidental Husband.
Oh, God, that's terrible.
That is one of the worst I've ever seen.
But P.S. I Love You, also pretty bad.
Not as bad as the Accidental Husband. Hey, anyway. All right.
If I asked you at gunpoint, you would choose P.S. I Love You over Accidental Husband?
Every time. Yeah. Well, Hilary Swank's always all right. Good for a laugh.
Yeah, but hang on. Has that got Jeffrey Butler and Jeffrey Dean Morgan in it?
Is it not Gerard Butler doing an Irish accent in it as well? And they will go back to his hometown.
I really hate Gerard Butler, but that's a topic for another time. Okay, number four is Lottery Ticket. Anyway, I'm sorry, Eat, Pray, Love took 12 million and is currently on 447 million. Lottery Ticket, do you know what that is?
It's one of those films like Barbershop and Friday and Soul Plane.
A black ensemble movie.
Yeah, but I don't know if it's from the same production line. That's why I always get confused, because there's a real difference in quality.
It's Queen Latifah in it.
Queen Latifah is in it, I believe.
Yeah. Awesome. I love Queen Latifah.
Also the guy who was in Percy Jackson.
Oh, he's Columbus Short. Is that him?
That's not him.
No, the other one. Brandon Jackson.
Something. Yeah, he's in it. And he's got quite a decent cast list, actually. Looks quite amusing. Apparently the idea is a character wins the lottery, but he can't claim it until the Monday after the weekend, so he's got to keep his lottery ticket safe in the hood over the course of a weekend. Sounds quite good, actually. I think that could be a laugh.
Yeah, okay. And number five is The Other Guys, which was at number three last week, and took 10 million, and is now at 88.9 million. So that's probably going to make it over 100. Whether we'll get The Other Guys too, I don't know.
I so hope so.
That would be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
We both saw that this week, and
we're embargoed, I believe.
Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah.
Six is, okay, very quickly, I will do the rest. I won't do the numbers, but yeah. Six is Piranha 3D. Seven is Nanny McPhee, which opened at number seven, which apparently is not good. Switch is the Jennifer Aniston, Jason Bateman movie. Opened at 8.1 million, also not considered very good. That movie is being, a bus went past as we were on the way to do this podcast with a poster for the Switch on it.
Well, wait, I've not seen it yet. So to me, based on the poster that we saw and based on the trailers and stuff that I've seen, it's a rom-com starring Jennifer Aniston and Jason Bateman. Is that right?
I don't think you can really call it a rom-com. It's being horribly sold as the latest Jennifer Aniston rom-com. Relatively speaking, she's barely in it. It's much more about Jason Bateman's character. But I suppose we can talk about it next week.
We'll go into more detail next week.
It's actually quite good. I did like it. But if you're going to see it thinking it's a Jennifer Aniston romantic comedy, it isn't. It's I would say it's more of a sort of relationship drama. It's got some funny bits in it, but they're mostly down to Jeff Goldblum. Inception's at number 9 and Scott Pilgrim. The reason I wanted to do the 10 instead of the 5 this week is that it has dropped 5 places in just 2 weeks to number 10. It took just 5 million. It's now on a total of 20.7 million, 7-something million, drop-off of 52.6%. I really think it's interesting that Expendables and Scott Pilgrim had the same drop-off, and yet the sort of difference is significant.
We know why that is, obviously.
Well, Expendables is only on 64.89.
And that is not a big number, I should say.
Yeah. They may not get to make Expendables 2 unless they break 100.
No.
And I don't know, I can see that staying in the top 10 for a couple more.
Well, Expendables, you've pointed out the drop-off there. Depending on what it's up against and how quickly it does fall away, it'll struggle over 100 million.
What is it up against? What's coming out next in the States? What's the big one?
I am not entirely sure.
We're terrible at doing research. You may have noticed that by now. we don't really think that far ahead.
Yeah.
So, this week's reviews, what do you want to start with? I suppose Scott Pilgrim.
Okay, we've talked about it for quite a while. We talked about it last week as well. Scott Pilgrim versus the World, out this week. Well, it's actually out on Wednesday, so you can catch it now. I will be very, very interested to see how it does in the UK. I think it's going to outperform its US performance quite considerably. And it basically stars Michael Cera as the titular Scott Pilgrim, who's a 22-year-old unemployed musician in the film, as he's cast in that role, who's got a girlfriend who is in high school. And there's humour to be had there. But the girl of his dreams literally walks out of his dreams into his life, and she's Ramona Flowers, and basically it's his pursuit of her. And eventually, when he gets her, that's when the film really starts, because to stay with her, he has to defeat her 7 evil exes.
I feel like I should give you a round of applause for that. He did that all in one breath.
I know.
You didn't mention it's based on a series of comic books by Brian Lee O'Malley.
Because I didn't know who it was by.
And I really loved it. I gave it a 5-star review this week. I thought it was just fantastic.
Yeah, as ever, Matthew giving 5 stars doesn't really mean anything. Here's what you need to know about it. I gave it 5 stars, and I've only given 4 5-stars this year so far. So there is.
You don't review everything, though.
I do, yeah. But even I do watch everything, though, and I wouldn't give. There's nothing that I've seen that would have got 5 stars.
Vincent Del Terrace.
That would not have got 5 stars, I can tell you that.
4.
Well, there you go. Even if you didn't give it a 5-star, I'm more than likely not going to give it 5-star. The point is that we both think it's excellent. The general vibe from people who we know and who...
And we're not just saying that because we've got Scott Pilgrim t-shirts.
No, we're not just saying that because we have nice fitting Scott Pilgrim t-shirts.
Fine.
yeah, boy. No, we really enjoyed it. We came out of the first screening, you know,
really buzzing about it.
Eager to see it again, which we've both done. Now, for you, that kind of diminished it slightly.
Yeah, but I think that might have been because it was at the end of a very long MovieCon weekend and I was kind of wanting some sleep.
Deja vu. I believe you said that last week.
I did, but I'm saying it again.
Why? We know.
Yeah, but just because I'm struggling to work out really why it was that I didn't enjoy it.
Well, I mean, I went to watch it.
But I'm reviewing it based on my first reaction, and I was just totally blown away by it. There's so many great jokes in it. I couldn't fit into the review. I mean, not that I would give away too many of the jokes anyway, but there's stuff like the opening credits, the logo, the Universal logo, being rendered like the opening of
an 8-bit video game.
That kind of gets the whole thing straight away.
Yeah.
I am also really interested in seeing how it does over here. And Charles Gant, in his box office column, mentioned this week the 10% rule, whereby you would expect it to do 10% in the UK of what it did in America. So I think it's comfortably going to do more than.
Well, that would be 1 million then.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suspect it would do more than that.
1 million is a fairly healthy opening over here.
I suspect it would do a lot better than that. It's a really good film. The X's are, you know, they're sort of cameo type roles, but they're really, really well done. Brandon Routh in particular I thought was excellent, and Chris Evans as well, not that one.
I think all the supporting characters are really brilliant. All the kind of little, I mean, everybody gets a little chance to shine, basically. I particularly liked Kieran Culkin, I think is really funny as his gay roommate. And do you watch Parks and Recreation?
I am aware of it. I don't watch it.
You've never seen it. Did you see Funny People?
Yeah.
Do you remember the girl that plays?
Yeah, she plays
Seth Rogen's girlfriend in Funny
Aubrey
People.
Something.
Aubrey Plaza.
Yeah,
she's really good in it too. She's played.
Who, as I understand it, is going out with Michael Cera in real life.
Oh, don't tell me that.
This is something that I picked up via.
Don't tell me that.
That's what you want in film.
Is that
you want
true?
To learn tidbits and chat like
true?
That, don't you? Yes, as I understand
that
it.
The sound you can hear, ladies and gentlemen, is the sound of my heart breaking into a million tiny pieces.
Aubrey
Plaza.
Yeah,
she's really great. You should see her in Parks and Recreation. She is hysterical. She just plays this kind of grumpy intern who doesn't want to do any work and kind of hates everyone and kind of has sarcastic put downs the whole time. She's very, very funny.
Like we say, the whole cast comes out of it really well. The direction is excellent. There's loads of, like, the Seinfeld reference in there and other bits and bobs in there that probably haven't noticed.
The laugh track bit was the only bit for me that didn't work. I thought that went on too long, that joke.
It just needed that theme, didn't it, rather than the whole, yeah.
One other thing, I was at a film quiz last night with some friends, and there's a lot of downtime in film quizzes while they mark the papers and stuff, and we were having an argument about why Scott Pilgrim had flopped and stuff like that, and we were saying, in the States, and we were saying, one of my friends was saying that nobody goes to see a movie based on, because Michael Cera's in it. He's not a movie star in that sense, and he was saying, I bet you could go out with, the quiz was in the Curzon Soho, and he was saying, I bet you could go out onto the street in the Curzon Soho and ask 100 people before you'd find somebody who knew who Michael Cera was. And we were arguing numbers, basically, and I was saying, no, I bet you maybe 10, and at most 20, but that would be all it would take. And he was saying, no, 100, no, 20. And I was thinking I might do this for next week, like do the Michael Cera test.
There you go.
The Michael Cera fame test. And I will ask 10 people from a random street sample if they know who Michael Cera is, and see. And we'll see who...
Well, that's the hook for next week, then. Matthew Turner out on the streets, terrorising, passing tourists.
I suppose I could do it with a microphone.
Yeah, a dictaphone, and you out and about asking people, do you know who Michael Cera is?
Yeah.
I think that's what...
Well, it would be interesting in one way. I mean, I am quite fascinated by the difference between... By what constitutes famous. To me, someone isn't famous unless my mum knows who they are. If my mum knows who they are, they're famous. If she doesn't, they're not.
That's going to be... Does she know who Michael Cera is, then?
No. But, you know, someone like Tom Cruise, Sylvester Stallone, she'd know them, but she wouldn't know Michael Cera.
Yeah.
Julia Roberts, she'd know as well, probably.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he's ever going to be a star, either. He doesn't do those sort of roles, and he doesn't.
But I think people will go and see a movie because he's in it, just because, and he has a fan base, basically.
A small number.
Yeah.
It's not exactly being marketed as a Michael Cera film.
No, his name's not even on the poster.
You see, I'm still at a loss to explain why it hasn't done anything in the US, and like we said, we'll be really interested to see what it does over here.
Okay, next film.
From the good to the bad, let's talk about Grown Ups.
Do we have to?
Very briefly, Grown Ups is the new Adam Sandler comedy, which also stars Chris Rock and Salma Hayek, and it's basically a group of 40-year-old men trying to recapture their youth. And that's the plot of the film, and that's also how it was made, I suspect. It's just those guys sitting around having a laugh that no one else is in on.
I was doing a lot of Chris Tookie-style sighing during that screening. Just awful, awful film. Not as bad as Old Dogs, which is the worst film of the year.
Yeah.
But, oh my God. The worst thing is, there's no effort that's gone into the writing of that movie at all.
Yeah, I mean, you're being very specific in your criticism.
I think you can use broad strokes here. What I'm trying to say is that no effort has gone into the script.
It's lazy, it's unfunny, it's not even...
The women have one character trait each.
Yeah.
Maria Bello, I mean, you feel sorry for every single one of them. Maria Bello, her character trait is that she's still breastfeeding her 4-year-old son. That's it. That's all there is to that character. Nothing else to that character. Salma Hayek, poor Salma Hayek. Salma Hayek is she's a bitch. Is that supposedly
a snooty fashion type person who wants to drag her family away and go off to Milan rather than hang around.
Yeah, that's her entire character. And Maya Rudolph, who's Chris Rock's wife, is heavily pregnant. That's it, I think, isn't it?
Pregnant. She was in it. How badly?
Yeah. She's pregnant. Is there anything else to that character? She's pregnant. No. She henpecks Chris Rock, who's a stay-at-home husband.
Yeah.
That's it.
And then there's the various...
Rob Schneider's girlfriend or wife is 80 years old.
Oh yeah.
And that's the
She's not the hot one, by the way. It's his kids that appear randomly and happen to be.
Yeah, the kids they give him two. Well, they give him two hot teenage daughters and a third not so hot daughter.
Yeah.
But those characters, there's nothing to those characters beyond have these characters in bikinis and David Spade lust after them. That's it.
Yeah, basically, it's trying to avoid. The raping from David Spade is what those characters have to go through. it's bad.
Don't go and see it, even if you're a big Adam Sandler fan.
No. All right, we've done...
Avatar.
Yeah, all right, Avatar. Avatar 3D Special Edition with 8 additional minutes from the original cut, which was still 162 minutes, and so now it's 170 minutes.
My friend Alex says it's 9 additional minutes now. He knows.
Hang on. I said 8 additional minutes of footage. Maybe that footage has caused a repercussion and the credits have had to go on for a minute longer.
Well, I don't know how he got 9 rather than 8, because I didn't really get time.
The official press release is 8 additional minutes.
Yeah.
Now look, I mean...
Right, yeah. So these 8 additional minutes, as far as I could see, contain a hunting sequence, where which is a lot like the buffalo hunt sequence in Dungeons with Wolves, where they're using the dragons or the banshees. They're flying on them and hunting a herd of stampeding creatures. That's quite a good scene, actually. The effects are really good on that. There's a death scene towards the end with Tsutse, which is the son?
He's the
younger tribal leader.
He's
anyway.
The warrior leader who would have become the tribal leader had he survived. But
yeah,
doesn't.
And there's the sex scene, which puts the which, let's just say, okay, you know they learn to fly the dragons by the thing in the end of their, there's a long ponytail,
yeah.
And they've got these kind of little strandy things,
yeah.
At the end of the ponytail, and they sort of plug that in,
yeah.
They insert the strandy things into the dragon, and that's how they kind of connect with it and learn to fly it,
yeah,
right. That's also how they have sex.
Yeah, but
he has sex with Neytiri by doing the exact same thing he does to the dragon. Now, call me crazy.
You're not crazy. Your mind's in the gutter there. They're connecting on another level.
In one they're having sex, and one they're... What's he doing to that dragon?
He's connecting with the dragon.
He's connecting with the dragon on a sexual level?
No, why is he connecting on a sexual
level? Because he's doing the same thing.
It is a bit weird, but I mean, you're making it.
Essentially,
more
he's putting his ponytail cock in the dragon's whatever.
Honestly, it's not salacious. It's meant to be a touching and moving moment.
I suspect that is why they cut the sex scene because it makes that connection too explicit.
I know that's not the reason they cut it. They cut it because it garners the reaction, which is more you're laughing at it rather than taking away the serious element of it. It wasn't cut because people were saying, oh my god, this is a sex scene, cut it out from a 12A film.
No, I didn't say that. I meant specifically, I bet they cut it because it makes that connection too explicit between the dragon raping and the sex.
We're quite rape heavy today.
Yeah, I know.
We might have to think about that a bit more.
I have to say, I really, really, really enjoyed watching it the second time. To be totally honest with you, I was dreading it. I thought I'd fall asleep because the cinema we saw in is really comfortable. I thought I'd fall asleep. I thought I wouldn't be able to tell where the new bits were. Oh, there's a scene in a school as well, which apparently is new.
Oh, there's a couple of scenes.
There's a Dr. Seuss book.
Yeah, and there's a scene that I was telling you about, which is
quite nice to know they're still reading Dr. Seuss in the year 2154.
Teaching the kids that. Yeah, no, there's a scene where they where the human characters sort of examine the wreckage of an attack, and they kind of examine how they were attacked, bows and arrows and sort of the antiquated weapons that are being used. That's apparently a new scene as well. But yeah, no, I'm like you. I really... The first time I saw it, I thought, as a one-off, big, loud, spectacular film, it's fine. I don't want to revisit this at any point, or certainly not within the next year or so.
Same.
So with it coming out on big screen again, first thing I thought is lazy cash-in. And the second thing I thought was, I'm really not going to enjoy it, and it's probably going to confirm all the negatives that I had about it. But if anything, I was able to let those negatives wash over me, which are mainly that the plot isn't very original at all. Like you say, Dances with Wolves and other things that we've seen. Yeah.
But you can let that, the Last Rainforest.
You can let all that stuff wash over you and take it in, and it is just an amazing cinematic experience.
I was totally hooked at the same time. I think partly as well, if you see it again, the expectation, the hype has died down. You know what you're seeing now, whereas before you didn't know what you were going to see. You didn't know what the story was. You didn't know, you didn't know how great it was going to be or how terrible it was going to be or anything like that. So. But now when you know what's going to happen and you know what the story is, you can kind of relax and enjoy it a bit more. And I really enjoyed it. I got much more out of it the second time. And I really wasn't expecting to. So it's definitely worth seeing again, basically. Also, hot tip, the Apollo West End, who I believe will be showing it, the extended edition, has, I've had this confirmed, the best available 3D technology in London.
Supposedly some sort of fourth generation 3D technology, which...
The definition is higher, apparently.
It was crystal clear from where we were watching. And also, the other thing is that a good seat anywhere in the house, basically, and you can get the full 3D effect. And they're really great seats as well. So, yeah, I recommend it as well.
It looked amazing. It looked absolutely amazing. I mean, it looked amazing first time around, but it looked stunningly good. Really, I mean, when they say the future of 3D, they're right in that that's what everybody should be aspiring to.
Yeah. Surprising recommendation from us there. One that we, last week, we were kind of sarcastic about it.
My friend before described Avatar to me as a 5-star experience and a 3-star movie. And I basically would agree with that. But I have to say, I'm glad I gave it 4 stars at the time, because that's definitely, I definitely stand by that now.
Yep. Also, this week is The Girl Who Played With Fire, the sequel to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
We really disagree on this one, don't we?
Yep, I loved it. I thought it was better than the first one. Lisbeth Salander, played by...
Noomi Rapace?
Yep.
Rapace.
Is excellent. I mean, I think everyone agrees with that. She's fantastic, both in this one and in the first film.
She's really striking on screen. She's a really striking presence.
Yeah.
I think that carries a lot of weight.
Such an original female character. You don't get the like of which anywhere else at the moment. But she's fantastic in this one. And the story this time focuses on her trying to clear her name for a gruesome murder which happens.
Triple murder,
which also involves the reporter Mikael
Blomqvist,
who the key thing with this film, and this is the reason I liked it, and this is the reason I think a lot of people didn't like it, is that those two characters who you saw together in the first film are kept separated for nearly the entire runtime of this film. And it is quite a lengthy runtime, 129 minutes. But yeah, they're kept separate, and that allows them to do what they do best individually. So you get her, the sort of determined, quite sort of rough and ready character that she is, trying to clear her name in her style, using her hacking skills, which you really didn't see much of in the first film.
Google skills.
Well, in this one.
Yeah.
So she's got some awesome tech, like her house is wired, and when Mr. Blomqvist breaks in, she kind of knows straight away, and that's a really clever scene as well. But Blomqvist, who you would not have gathered was any sort of journalist or, you know, had any sort of credential in that department from the first film, he's kind of hired out early on, and he starts becoming this investigative sort of, not even a reporter, just
what do you mean you wouldn't have gathered he's a journalist? That's what he gets arrested for in the first place.
Yeah, but he gets arrested early on. That's off camera, isn't it? He's arrested.
Yeah, because he's a journalist, because the report he's done is blindly.
He doesn't do anything journalistic, does he? He becomes a private eye all of a sudden. No, you wouldn't hire
a journalist. Using his journalism, investigative journalist skills to solve that case.
It doesn't make any sense. Hey, there's a murder mystery going on here. Let's get someone from the News of the World to sort it out. That's what we need. Bollocks,
Robbie Collin
will sort it out in 5 minutes. You didn't get to see that in the first film, and I really enjoyed the fact that in this film...
I totally disagree. He uses his executive journalism
skills. He's not a journalist.
What do you think? The word investigate is an investigative journalist.
And there's a second part of that phrase.
But the work is still the same. The sources are still the same.
Yeah, but he wasn't doing it.
What are you talking about?
There's more limitations than your journalist.
Are you seriously going to sit there and tell me that an investigative journalist has nothing to do with being a detective?
An investigative journalist has responsibilities to the paper that he's writing for.
You don't see him write the story, do you?
You see him getting ready to write. You see him having... The reason he takes it on...
I think it's a fairly pointless argument. And
the reason he takes it on is because the newspaper or the magazine that he works for, Millennium, is writing a report, and that kind of implicates the characters who end up dying.
The guy that gets killed comes to him as a separate journalist that he's working on. They hire him but it's a story that he's working on that he brings to them that they agree to publish, and they get to use the magazine's resources. Yeah. So they're already connected, and then he gets murdered, and so he decides to investigate the story he was working on, which turns out to be about sex trafficking.
Not entirely true. The reason he decides to investigate really is
to clear her name.
She's implicated in it.
Yeah.
Because the third person who gets murdered is the character from the first film.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, bottom line is I really enjoyed it. You did it.
Okay, well, my problem, I've got several problems with it. One, exactly like you said, I think it's a big... I love the first one, really love the first one. I gave the first one 5 stars. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. To me, it felt like a traditional detective story, which is why I was having that argument with you. It really felt like a traditional detective story.
It really hamstrung the character of Lisbeth, though. After the first half, but she just becomes a damsel in distress, sort of banging onto him.
One of the things I really loved about the first film is their chemistry together, and to deprive the second film of that completely by having them, like I say, not meet until nearly the end. Just, I don't know. And then, okay, something else. It's way too faithful to the book, because there's a big stretch in the middle. Without giving too much away, there's a big stretch in the middle that involves two separate characters. There's a barn scene. A character gets kidnapped, another character comes to rescue that character, the barn gets set on fire, and that goes on for 10, a few minutes You cannot have, in a movie like, with two kind of characters, characters like Blomqvist and Salander, you cannot have a long stretch like that where neither of those characters are on screen for a long time, and you're basically... I just didn't care.
No, that's the problem with it. It's not the fact that those two aren't in it. It's the fact that we're watching two characters that we have very little introduction to.
Yeah.
And that we don't know enough to care about in that particular scene.
The whole way through that scene, I was expecting either Blomqvist or Salander to turn up and rescue them.
It does make it more realistic, though, that they don't come in. That the investigative journalist doesn't break into this barn and save a big, burly boxer from a beating. It kind of makes more sense, but I agree. It's two characters that we don't know enough about playing out a scene that we don't care about.
And I felt as well that I don't think it's as well shot as the first film. It's certainly not, the imagery certainly isn't as kind of striking.
It doesn't feel as localised.
It really feels like a it was made for TV, but it really feels like a made for TV movie in the way it looks and everything. The mystery to me isn't nearly as compelling as in the first film.
The solving of the mystery isn't
as interesting as in the first film.
The first film's mystery was awful.
And they kind of throw in stuff from other sources just to kind of, you know, it's like grafting on kind of things to make it more interesting, exciting. Like, there's this character that's straight out of a Bond movie, basically, a sort of tall, blonde giant who can't feel any pain. That's basically an amalgamation of Jaws. But that's still a fault of the story, which is what I'm saying.
Again, the story has very little to do with the film. That story, if it's faithful to the book,
then
you can complain about the book, which is ironic, because everyone who I know who has read all three books says this is the best book. The second one is the best book.
Really?
Yeah.
To be fair, I didn't hate it. In fact, reading my review, I was really horrible to it in the review, but actually I still gave it 3 stars. I did like it. I just didn't think it was as good as the first film. I was disappointed compared to how high my expectations were. But what gets it through and what makes it work for me are the two characters. They are really watchable. I mean, they're great. They're really good actors. They're very watchable. You're interested in them the whole time and what they're up to. And it's fun watching them investigate, like you say, but it just wasn't there for me. It just didn't grab me the way the first film did. I wasn't really blown away by it the way I was.
Very solid 4 from me. It had the spark that I felt was lacking from the first one. And like I said, if the key to the whole series...
I didn't think it had the spark that the whole one had.
Key to the franchise is the Elizabeth Salander character. And I just thought in this, you get to see her in her full glory, sort of doing exactly what she's supposed to do. In the first one, as soon as the man is on the scene...
In this, there's nothing to this, the sex scene in this film beyond lesbian titillation.
But they established that this is her girlfriend from a while back, and it's the first time they've met. If you think it's too...
It's gratuitous,
in the way it's done on film, all right, but...
It certainly doesn't serve a point in the...
No, it certainly does. The character...
In the first movie, you've got a scene where she wakes up in bed where you see her... The reason, if you haven't read the books in the first movie, you see her wake... And you don't know she's a lesbian. You see her wake up in bed with a woman in the first movie.
Right.
Do you see them having sex in that movie?
No.
Do you understand that she's a lesbian?
Yeah.
I'm
not saying the reason this sequence is in the film is to establish that she's a lesbian. I'm saying it's there to explain the fact that she's meeting her girlfriend, not just some random woman. It's her girlfriend who she's...
It's not needed.
Well, I mean, it's not needed as much as the sex scene in the first one. They could have just woken up in bed together and you would have gathered they had sex and it would have meant what it meant.
Yeah.
I think...
No, the whole point of the first movie is the seduction that leads to it. It was seduction. The kind of... She basically just comes in and fucks him, doesn't she? Pretty much. I mean, they're both in separate bits.
And that's a reduction in your book, is it?
I mean...
Right, okay.
No, I mean...
We're going around in circles on a film that we've spent far too much time on. Girl Who Played With Fire is out this week. If we can briefly... I've already said that. If we can briefly go through some of the other releases this week.
Right. Diary of a Wimpy Kid, based on an illustrated children's book that started online... And then turned into a series of books about an 11-year-old kid who starts middle school, and he's got his fat best friend Rowley, and he has a series of schemes to become popular in middle school, and the schemes keep going wrong. There's a lot of things I really liked about the film, such as the treatment of the fat kid. Like normally you'd expect the fat kid in a movie like this to be, he's a bit stupid as well. You'd expect that character to be the butt of all the jokes and be kind of constantly humiliated or doing stupid things or saying stupid things or whatever. And although it starts off like that, it starts off like that in a little way. Halfway through the film, that character, the lead character basically throws, they have this game, so he throws a ball at him and he crashes the thing he's riding on and he breaks his hand or his wrist. And so then he has his arm in a cast, and that makes the fat friend popular. And suddenly... And then it becomes clear that all the kids in the school actually like the kid for who he is. He's funny. He's he's nice, and he genuinely does become popular in the way that the lead character wants to. And he gets to do the school cartoon, and basically everybody loves him. And that's really different to the way those films normally. I mean, actually, the whole film is actually about their relationship, which again is a really different sort of thing for that sort of film. There's no kind of love interest or anything. They're only 11. But there's no kind of like girl he's trying to win over or anything like that. My only problem with it though is the lead character is just not likable enough to make it work. He's pretty horrible to his friend. He does some fairly unlikable things. He's quite arrogant in his kind of quest for popularity. He's quite dismissive of everybody. Chloe Moretz is in it, but she's totally wasted. She's an older girl that gives them advice that he kind of ignores. It goes a little too far with caricature, having done really great work with the fat kid in terms of resisting the usual cliches. It then has these two horribly caricatured characters: the girl who's his kind of evil nemesis, and a weird freckly ginger kid called Fregley. No, it's gone.
All right. Anyway, okay. So that's Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
The Dog Pound.
Yeah, Dog Pound is the one I really wanted to talk about.
Just basically Scum, a remake of Scum.
Is this not a remake though? Is it?
It is a remake.
Is
it's,
it?
It's shot for shot.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Actually.
Okay. Sort of three or four unknown characters or unknown actors in the lead roles. Set in a U.S. juvenile correctional facility. And they find themselves in there, and they basically have to kowtow to the hierarchy within the prison and the guards as well. In Scum, is there also the guards who have their sort of personal lives interfering with their... Because I thought that was quite good.
It's been a really long time since I've seen it.
But basically, it gives you an insight into the characters who are within that prison, not just the prisoners themselves, but also the guards. And the guards aren't just your standard caricature bullying guards and the caring, sharing guards and stuff like that. You get them to, you see how their private lives kind of interfere with their professional lives and how that impacts the other characters around them. And yeah, there's not anything really original within it, but it's done really well.
Is it a French film?
Or this?
Yeah.
I think there's French money behind it, yeah. French, US co-production in some way.
Mm. There's a European feel to it, I would say.
It does have that feel to it. It kind of, yeah. It doesn't have that sheen or that gloss that you'd expect from an American movie of that sort. And the characters do things that aren't exactly what you would expect from a US lead or a Hollywood sort of star strutting through a prison, getting his own way. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
Quite harrowing, obviously. It kind of leaves you...
No cats in bins, though, with Dog Pound.
No, unfortunately. Well, no, fortunately not. It leaves you quite shaken by the end of it. I was really gripped by the story. I was really gripped by the film. The performances from these four or five unknown guys, basically, they're all fantastic in it, I thought.
So if there's only three...
There's three young... there's three
guys...
Are you counting the bad guy? Yeah, I'm counting the bad guy, yeah. Okay. And the guard as well, who I suspect we have seen somewhere, but he's quite important to the film.
Worth mentioning, without going into any detail, worth mentioning that I actually like both the other two films this week, The Maid and Wardo Dem. Mm. Anyway, and Wardo Dem is like Monsters, only without the aliens. It's about a guy, it's basically a road movie in South America.
Okay, well, you've done yourself a great favour there by introducing Monsters, which is at Fright Fest. If we can briefly talk about Fright Fest itself now and some of the films to look out for.
Okay, well, the best one, in my opinion, is the closing night film, The Last Exorcism, which is produced by Eli Roth. It's one of those kind of found footage documentary, found footage, supposed found footage movies, i.e. it's documentary footage, mock documentary footage, about a preacher who is a sort of fake, he does fake exorcisms, basically, and he invites the documentary crew along to see, to see what's involved in doing that. And he decides he's going to answer the first letter. He gets letters all the time asking him to come around and do an exorcism. decides he's going to do the first letter. He opens the letter and ends up going out. They go after this I think it's a father, a son, and a daughter.
Mm.
And the daughter's supposedly possessed. And basically it gets creepier and creepier and creepier. And I don't want to give anything else away, really.
What I really liked was how it kind of kept that line between is it real or is there something supernatural going on all the way through, up until something that happens towards the end of the film, which we won't spoil. But yeah, no, I really liked it as well. Again, I was kind of sick of the mock documentary format, especially within the horror film sort of genre. And this kind of plays with that in as much as it knows what it's doing, and it leads on to something that you're really not expecting it to go to. And very different from an Eli Roth film as well. It's quite subtle. Which is...
Well, he didn't direct it.
No, but still, his name attached normally ensures some sort of...
I think he knows it's a good film. I think that's, it's yeah, a good idea, and he knows that his name will sell horror movie tickets, so it's a good move on his part, probably.
Yeah, the good thing is, with this, if you can't catch it at Fright Fest, when it's been on Monday, it's out on general release on Friday. So, and we'll talk more about it, I guess, next week. So
yeah,
if we move on to the other highlights, you've been talking about something that you saw at Edinburgh, which I haven't seen yet.
Monsters. Yeah, directed by an up-and-coming British director called Gareth Edwards, who will, mark my words, be a big star, I think. He'll be snapped up, but I would imagine Hollywood will snap him up and he'll do some big thing next. People are calling it, like, this year's District 9. I think that's doing it a disservice, because it's not... The story isn't about the monsters, despite the title having monsters in it. It's basically set in the future a little way in the future, where aliens have crash-landed in South America, and basically there's a large part of South America that's colonized by squid-like aliens, giant squid-like aliens. But life goes on, basically, the way it does after any national disaster. Like after Hurricane Katrina, for example, life still has to go on, even when all the news cameras go away, and stop reporting on the story, that life for the people in the area still goes on. Mm-hmm. So the large chunk of South America has been quarantined, but you can still go there. And Scoot McNairy, who was in one of my favourite films, In Search of a Midnight Kiss, Scoot McNairy and an actress called Whitney Able, apparently they're married now as well. Anyway, she plays like a rich, essentially like a kind of Rupert Murdoch figure's daughter, his boss's daughter anyway, and he has to go and get her back. He has to go and escort her to US border safety, basically. And it's just a road movie in South America, but with giant alien squids in the background. And it's very good. It's really well shot. It's the effects. He did all the effects on a laptop in his home, apparently. It's just, and it,
so he says.
Yeah, so he says. It's just really good. It's really hard to explain what works about it. And I wasn't on board. Everybody's raving about it at Edinburgh, and I wasn't quite on board with all the raves at Edinburgh, except that every film I saw after, I saw it really early on, and every film I saw afterwards only made Monsters look better by comparison. And I'm really looking forward to seeing it again, because I am fully on board the Monsters train. I'm going to, I do think it's excellent. I mean, I thought it was excellent anyway,
I'm looking forward to it. I mean, I've heard a lot about it since Edinburgh and subsequent to that as well. A lot of rave reviews coming in for that.
It's essentially Frightfest's biggest film, I think. I think they're expecting a lot of
It is now attention. Given that a Serbian film has been pulled, which is one that we were going to talk about, but no real need to do that now, especially since we mentioned it early on. Same with I Spit on Your Grave as well, mm-hmm. which is one of the big ones. The opening film, which we're on our way to see very shortly, actually, is Hatchet 2.
Yeah, looking forward to that. I've
not seen the first one, actually.
You haven't seen the first one?
No.
Where were you when that came out?
I believe I was...
cowering under your seat somewhere?
Yeah.
At home,
possibly.
Crying?
I was... I don't know. When was it out, actually?
2006. You were still at school?
Yeah, I was still at school. No, I wasn't doing this full time then. I think I was being a bit more selective.
Yeah, I mean, should be good. First one was good fun. So, looking forward to it. There's a lot of... I mean, Adam Green is not special guest, what's the word? Friend of Frightfest, I guess. But Adam Green and his friend Joe Lynch, who also directed, I think, Wrong Turn 2 and some other stuff.
Well, he's come over. Which one's Frozen?
That's Adam Green.
And he's done Hatchet 2 as well?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they come over every year, basically. They make little short films to play between films and stuff like that. They're very funny.
Excellent stuff. So, yeah, those are the big highlights, I guess. I'm sure there'll be other stuff that Matthew will watch.
There's an interview with Tobe Hooper. He's doing a Q&A.
Mr. Hooper, or
he's doing an on-stage retrospective after a screening of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Frightfest, I think, apart from the big high-profile films, you've got to kind of take a chance and just go and find out for yourself, basically. The posters and the word of mouth won't really tell you enough to let you know whether a film is good or not.
Yeah. Last year, for example, I saw, well, apart from Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and The Human Centipede, I saw one of the best films I've seen actually all year, which is a film called Best Worst Movie, which I think it's gone straight to DVD now. If it has, you check it out. It is absolutely fantastic. It's basically a documentary about Troll 2.
Right.
Which is this kind of notoriously terrible... It used to be on the IMDb list as the worst movie of all time. And I mean, I've never seen Troll 2, but they showed enough clips of it in Best Worst Movie to give you a good idea. And then the director of Best Worst Movie was one of the child actors in Troll 2.
Right.
And the film gets picks up a certain sort of cult reputation, and they start getting screened at like midnight screenings at universities and things. And the kid is now obviously grown up, is interested in this and starts documenting this. And then he goes and asks, he tracks down the cast members and interviews them about this. And they're all really excited to hear about it. They obviously don't know about it. They're really excited to hear about it. And one cast member in particular gets involved and starts going around to screenings and doing Q&As afterwards. And it just all sort of kind of cannonballs, and they get other cast members involved. But then they contact the director, who's this kind of like bargain basement Fellini type, Italian.
Right.
And they bring him over.
And he's like, he can't believe that, he thinks his genius is finally being recognised after all these years. He can't believe that, you know, cinemas and things are putting on late night screenings and Q&As of his film, and he's delighted. And then he's sitting there and watching it with an audience, and the audience are obviously all pissing themselves laughing because it's terrible. And he's sitting there going, why are they laughing? They're not. This isn't supposed to be funny. And he just gets really, really angry. He stands up in the Q&As and starts heckling them and heckling the people on the stage and insulting them. It's really, really funny. You've got to see it. It is an absolutely fantastic film. One of the best films I've seen in a really long time.
I think the one that'll have that effect is Fanboys this year, which is one of the ones being shown at some point. And it's already Fanboys, got a DVD date as well.
I think Fanboys could go either way. It's going to be fun because it's because of the card. It's got, is it Jay Baruchel?
Yeah.
Seth Rogen, William Shatner, Christian Bell. It's about a group of nerds breaking into George Lucas' Skywalker Ranch to steal the first copy or watch the first copy of Phantom Menace. I really hope it ends with them really hating it.
Yeah, that would be what, they break in and then they try and destroy it because it's so awful.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, so that's Fright Fest.
The thing is, though, if Fanboys was really any good, it would be in the main screen, I reckon.
I don't know. I mean, I've seen some of the stuff on the main screen and it's not really quality control there, to be fair.
What have you seen? I've seen Red Hill, which is okay, but not great.
Which I think, because it's a British film in that genre, you can understand why it's on the main screen, but I don't think it's significantly better than some of the ones on the other screen.
I've seen Cherry Tree. Have you seen Cherry Tree Lane?
Not yet.
I like Cherry Tree Lane, but it's not really a horror movie all the sort of horrible stuff that happens is kept deliberately off screen. Mm. And I think the Fright Fest audience are not an audience that are satisfied with stuff being
They're
going to
be baying for more blood and...
I think they will, yeah.
And stuff. Okay. Okay, look. I think we're going to get kicked out in 10 minutes or so, so we really should move on. Fright Fest, I guess we'll give you more of a feedback next week once we've seen it. So, yeah, that's that. That is...
DVD of the week. DVD of the week.
Oh, we're going to do that then, are we?
We are... Well, just because I think the film I want to flag up, I mean, I don't like the film that you've got for DVD of the week, but the one I'm...
You don't like up, the film? Or you?
I just didn't think it was as good as everyone else did. Okay. That's really going to tank my arse. The one I want to flag up is a British gangster film. And I know, when I say the word British gangster film, everyone goes, oh, God, is Danny Dyer in it? No, Danny Dyer's not in it. It's a British gangster film in that it's a British film and it's about gangsters, but it's much more of a sort of kitchen sink drama.
Ooh,
the plot is basically this, and it's sort of black, it's got a kind of black comedy element to it too. Basically, this father and son escape, a grown-up father, 60-something-year-old father and his 30-something-year-old son narrowly escape going to prison, and they're involved in crime in some way, and they come home.
One second, do you want to tell us what this film is?
It's called Down Terrace.
Oh, thank
you. Did I not say that already?
No, you didn't.
I panicked. So they come home, and they're sitting around in their living room, and they're trying to work out who grassed them up, basically, and various friends come around to sort of, you know, say congratulations for escaping jail, and they're kind of suspicious of everybody, and, you know, the woman, Julia Deakin, who plays Marsha in Spaced.
Right, yeah.
She's the mother. And she's really great in it. She delivers this kind of really chilling performance, this kind of darkly funny and also, you know, quite scary. And it's just really good. And the arguments about who's going to paint the living room are as kind of compelling as the arguments about who's going to kill this guy or that guy or whatever. And it's a really interesting, well-made film. It's funny and it's chilling and it's dark, it's black comedy. And there's a bit with a sort of rubbish hitman, for example, who's one of the friends that comes around to sort of see them, and he's talking about whether he should, if they've got any work for him to do, and the son asks him if he has a web presence. it's just weird. It's a really, but it's good. Anyway, okay. Out on DVD from Monday, I think.
It was out on Monday.
It was out on DVD this Monday.
Okay. Also came out on Monday was Lebanon, which is, as you alluded to, Dust Boot in a Tank?
Yes. Well, that's not my quote. No,
that's a pretty lazy sort of characterisation of
it. If you're expecting Dust Boot in a Tank, you're going to be very disappointed.
Yeah, because it's not 3 and a bit hours long, and you might get to watch it in one night. It's actually a really well-made film. I think it's told from the point of view of four soldiers in a tank, Israeli soldiers,
During the first Israel-Lebanon war or conflict, as it was, I think, in the early 80s. And it's them in this very confined space. The point of view they see out into the world is from the tank. And
the tank's point of view?
Yeah, it's the tank's point of view. The tank's got a great motivation in this film. And yeah, it's them being trapped behind enemy lines and then trying to escape again. And the sort of moral conflicts that they're going through. Paints really great characters, really gives you an insight into what these...
See, I don't think the characters are great in that film. I think they're all very interchangeable, and I struggle to tell them apart. It's one of them that's off screen for most of the movie.
I thought it was really well made, and I think we were discussing these sort of Israeli-Palestinian films a while ago, and they do tend to be very one-note and very sort of afraid to offend anyone, so they just end up being completely inoffensive. But by that token, they end up being really unimportant and uninvolving. This one, because it isn't about the conflict itself and about the four characters and that point of view, I thought it kind of told a really great story, and it was really well done. Very well made by the director as well, who should know because he was involved in the conflict himself.
Right. Ordinarily, in the podcast, this would be the bit where we would answer questions that people had sent in for us to answer.
We've got so many. Nobody
sent any questions.
Or we've got so many that in the limited time we can't answer them. That's the way I'd like to think about it.
I don't think we should lie to our listeners.
None of you lazy fuckers bothered emailing
in. When I asked people to email in their ideas for books to be made into films, or books they wanted to see made into films, not one single person...
I think next time, when we see someone and they say, oh, what you should do is, save it, put it in an email, send it to us, we'll discuss it. Otherwise...
Come on, answer me honestly. Did anybody actually make it to the end of our last podcast? Because, frankly...
Because you missed the best bit, if you didn't.
Yeah, that's true, actually, yeah. I was thinking we should... I've got some freebie stuff to give away, and
we could
hide a phrase in the podcast,
right?
And the first person to email us that phrase, which would prove that they'd heard the phrase in that point in the podcast.
So it's quite a brief today as well because we're in the middle of Fright Fest, and Matthew hasn't done his work for this week, lazy cunt.
Oi!
Next week's big releases.
There's a lot of releases. Isn't
it? Yeah, I mean,
it's 13.
13 big releases. Jonah Hex is out next week, which stars Josh Brolin, and my rule of thumb is that there's no such thing as a bad Josh Brolin film.
No such thing as a bad Josh Brolin performance. I didn't like American Gangster, though.
You didn't like American Gangster?
No.
He was that was when he was doing a film a week.
Josh Brolin's moustache, best thing in American Gangster.
But he was doing a plethora of films. Anyway, there's loads of other films as well. The fact that we're talking about Josh Brolin in Jonah Hex and not Megan Fox kind of tells you what that film is.
I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it.
I'm seeing it in the National Pressure.
Well, there you go. Something to look forward to.
I am looking forward to it. You said it's all right. It's bad.
Yeah. Ignore the US reviews. The reaction here is quite different to the US one, I think. There are flaws, and they'll be evident, and it's obvious by the fact that it's only 80 minutes long. Jonah Hex, The Switch, which we talked about, and... like you say, 10, 11 other films. We'll talk about all of those and more next week. Tune in. Matthew, do you want to say anything else while we close?
No, I think that's it. I think you've covered everything.
Yep, Ian, my hoarse voice, have covered everything. It's miraculous that I managed to get through it, to be honest. Well done. Well done, me.
Well done, Cassan.
Matthew
well
sat done. Here in the Blag of the Week as well, which is his Scott Pilgrim t-shirt. The green one,
not one of the red and gold ones that you were covering.
Yeah, I was after one of those. I do have an extra bonus, but I'll give you an insight into that next week.
I can't believe they send you a soundtrack without you asking for
it's
one.
It's not a soundtrack.
You told me it was a soundtrack.
No, it's something else. You'll see what next week.
You've got to tell me.
No.
You've got to fucking tell me what it is.
See you next week. Tune in for that, Matthew finding out what I got.
You told me it was a soundtrack.
Yeah, because I was trying to put you off the scent. Something that I got that Matthew didn't get, and now he's going to be all... jealous and crazy about it. Don't worry.
I'm sulking.
I got it. Anyway, okay, thank you very much. Nothing else. Tune in. What's the Twitter and blog account that they need to do?
They're both the same. Twitter is at Turner and Looch, and the blog is turnerandlooch.blogspot.com.
And you'll be able to find this show and the last one on there as well.
And it's on Podbean, I suppose.
Yeah. It's turnerandlooch.podbean.com. Yeah, thank you very much. Goodbye.